GBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay, and always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. In an interview with ABC's Karen Travers, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas was asked what he'd say to migrants trying to cross the U.S. southern border.
The message to intending migrants is very clear. To risk one's life and one's life savings only be returned is not the prudent, safe thing to do.
The pandemic rule Title 42 comes to an end this week. Immigration and Customs will roll out a new program that requires asylum-seeking families apprehended at the border to wear a GPS monitor and adhere to a curfew. The Coast Guard is searching for a downed aircraft off the Southern California coast of San Clemente Island. It was contracted by the Navy. Republican New York Congressman George Santos has entered a not guilty plea to 13-count federal indictment on charges including wire fraud and money laundering. This is ABC News. The U.S. has approved more than $42 billion in federal student loan debt forgiveness for more than 615,000 borrowers over the past 18 months. It is part of a program aimed at getting more people to work in public service jobs. A California police department is facing a new investigation.
The Antioch Police Department, northeast of Oakland, is a focus of multiple investigations, including one by the FBI, over allegations that many of the department's officers were sending racist text messages and allegations of civil rights abuses against people of color. Now, California Attorney General Rob Bonta says his office is opening a civil rights investigation.
There may well have been a breach of trust in the Antioch Police Department.
He says his office's goal is to implement corrective action inside the department. Alex Stone, ABC News.
Norfolk Southern says it will establish a fund to reimburse homeowners who live near the site of that toxic train derailment in East Palestine, who sell their homes for less than what the property was worth before the incident. Andy Field, ABC News.
Thanks for listening to your local Civic Media radio station. Learn more on our website, civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. Here's what you need to know. 2023 is the deadliest year for law enforcement officers in Wisconsin in 20 years. St. Croix County Sheriff Scott Knudsen was Deputy Katie Lysing's boss. She's the fourth law enforcement officer killed in Wisconsin so far this year.
We need good cops. We're killing the good cops. And it's frustrating.
Lysing was shot and killed in a traffic stop last Saturday. Milwaukee County leaders are striking out a local buy-in to help maintain American Family Field. The idea was voted down in committee Monday. Republicans say lawmakers want Milwaukee and Milwaukee County to pay at least part of the $300 million to keep the stadium maintained. In sports, the Dodgers beat the Brewers last night 6-2. The rubber match of the series is today. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
Are record high energy and water costs putting a squeeze on your fixed or limited incomes? With inflation rising at record levels and incomes not keeping pace, you might be one of tens of thousands of Wisconsin residents who are struggling to survive. While you may not ask for it, the Keep Wisconsin Warm Cool Fund and your local energy assistance providers are here to help. No Wisconsin resident should ever have to be without heat, water, or power. For a hand up, apply today and call 1-800-506-5596. That's 800-506-5596. Or visit www.heat.help. That's www.heat.help.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios. Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving.
Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
VA has a new life insurance program for veterans with service-connected disabilities called Veterans Affairs Life Insurance, or VA Life. VA Life benefits include up to $40,000 in coverage, no medical questions to enroll, and no time limit to apply if you are age 80 or under. Veterans can apply, receive an instant decision, and manage their policy online. Learn more about VA Life or apply online by visiting va.gov/life-insurance. Protect those who matter most with VA Life Insurance.
I'm Smokey Bear, and I made an assistant to help you out, because only you can prevent wildfires.
Hey, Assistant Smokey Bear, call me Papa Bear, because I'm grilling up dinner. Do you get it?
Yes, good job.
So, what should I do with all these coals?
Don't just toss them out. Put them in a metal container, because those embers can start a wildfire.
I understand. The stakes are high.
Ha, 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 ha.
Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council.
Looking for more local programming? Check out our website, civicmedia.us, to see our entire lineup.
And we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Vice President Kamala Harris has pulled out of an MTV event. Look, you know, you're not going to cross a picket line. She's standing in solidarity with the Writers Guild. Writers, because they're on strike, as you know, and you would expect nothing less out of this administration. And look, we're in a moment right now where labor activity is at a high, labor approval is at a high, and I keep saying we've got to go back, learn the lessons of the past so that we don't make the mistakes in the future, and understand, you know, what it took to build that most prosperous working class that our grandparents' generation built. There were strikes, there were sit-ins, there were all kinds of things that, well, we didn't learn in history class, which is why I was thrilled to find over at PBS, there is a film on the Memorial Day Massacre, and that's why I've asked Greg Mitchell to come talk with us. Greg is an author, also the film's director of Memorial Day Massacre. Workers Die, Film Buried. We'll get links out on social media. You can take a look at it at gregmitchphoto.com/the Memorial Day Massacre with dashes between them. We'll get links out. Trust me, you'll find it. Greg, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, I'm very, very pleased to be here.
So why this now? I mean, this happened back in 1937. This is a past, way in the past, been right. Buried for so long. Why does this matter now?
Well, it matters, as you mentioned. There is a surge in union activity today, and it's sort of alarming when you find that so few people in general, and even a lot of workers and union people and their families don't really know the history of this particular incident, which amazingly is largely forgotten today, even though 10 workers were shot and killed by Chicago police, and none of the police ever suffered because of it. They actually shot 40 people, the majority of them in the back as they ran away. So it's a totally shocking, and I often do write books or make films about incidents that when I hear about them or read about them, I say, you know, exactly what you just said. How come I don't know about this? I've written a dozen books. I've directed 3 films now, and almost all of them come back to that question, you know, why don't I or why don't we know about this? So when that happens, it really gets my attention, and then I probe more deeply into it.
No, it's good that you do. In fact, you've got a book out now and an ebook available at barnesandnobles.com titled the same thing, Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. So the film buried part of this was 1937. You know, there weren't right. cameras everywhere like there are today. And there was a film of this. There, you know, I guess it was Paramount who had a film out there, film crew taking pictures of this. And they decided this was not just someone said, let's hide this. There was a decision to not release the film, wasn't there?
That's right. Yeah. Well, of course, as a lot of people know, newsreels were incredibly popular then, almost as popular as TV today. People went to the movies all the time then, and they all had newsreels before them. So Paramount was one of the leading newsreel companies, and they had a cameraman at the scene. Just to set the scene a little bit, this is in 1937. It was sort of the peak of labor activity. There had been the whole wave of sit-in strikes at General Motors and Ford, et cetera. And so there was a great steel strike across the Midwest and Pennsylvania, what they called the little steel companies, but they weren't little. And so they called a strike to try to get what workers at the U.S. Steel had gotten. And, they called their first picket lines, and the police clubbed them and sent a lot of people to the hospital. So they called for a picnic on Sunday, Memorial Day. It was celebrated on a Sunday then. And for a family picnic and for other workers to show up and show solidarity with the strikers. And so they got a turnout of maybe 1,500 people, a beautiful sunny day, a lot of children, a lot of women. And so they decided, well, let's march towards the Republic Steel plant in South Chicago, and we'll try to set up a legal mass picket line, as they had been told they could. Halfway there, the police, a giant mass of police, stopped them and would not let them go further. And then the police started firing at point-blank range. Everyone, including the women and children in the crowd, ran away. And as I mentioned, 40 in all were shot, the majority of them in the back or the side. And then the police went through the crowd and clubbed people, again, including women lying on the ground. So you had another 50 people who went to the hospital with head injuries. You would think this was an incredible scandal that would reverberate around the country. But in fact, the media, with rare exceptions, pictured this as the police having to stop these marchers, police defending property, police defending the workers who were back in the plant. And in fact, even the major papers, New York Times, Washington Post, et cetera, pictured this as a riot, that the police had been attacked by a mob. And that carried today for two or three weeks. But as you mentioned, the second part of my subtitle, Film Buried, is because a Paramount cameraman did catch all this. He showed police firing on them. He showed them clubbing people as they ran away. And Paramount suppressed the footage. It did not come out for over a month. And the only reason it did come out was because of one investigative reporter and a crusading senator, Robert La Follette, of a progressive from Wisconsin. And so the footage finally came out after more than a month. And even then, it was banned by officials in Chicago, in St. Louis, and some other cities. So,
of course it was.
It's an incredible story. But and like I said, it made me say, 10 killed? How is it possible? I don't know this.
Yeah, now you'd have some people today, Greg, say, well, that couldn't happen today. Our news media wouldn't suppress, this kind of behavior, because we don't shoot workers anymore, do we? we don't do that much anymore, right?
Well, this in fact was the last really major kind of confrontation where there were so many lives lost. This is there were shortly after this, there were a couple who were shot in, I think, Youngstown. But in fact, if you want to say both the workers and the police kind of learned a lesson, in the sense that they did try to cool the kind of confrontations that would lead to this kind of violence, because of the shocking number of people, shot and killed here. This really stands. There's nothing comparable to 10 people getting, getting killed in a single day. So if you want to say there's some positive after effect, it was in a way that, we haven't seen quite such a bloody Sunday since then in the U.S.
You listen to the Rick Smith Show here with Greg Mitchell. Greg's the author of Memorial Day Massacre, Workers Die, Film Buried. We'll get links out on social media how you can pick that up, or you can go to barnesandnoble.com and get that. He's also the film's director of the Memorial Day Massacre film. Highly suggest taking a look at that. You can find it over at pbs.org, or we'll get the link out to gregmitchphoto.com where you can get the film as well. Because it's free now to watch, right? You can, anybody can go and stream it online. In fact, we want people to do that, right?
Yeah, it premiered over the weekend on PBS, and now it's up on their site at pbs.org. You can find it. It's 27 minutes, and it's totally free, and you can watch it streaming on any PBS app or right on your computer.
Outside of just the facts, ma'am, that this is what happened. Do you hope something comes out of this, an education process? Do you hope people pay attention, some kind of cautionary tale? Is there something you're hoping comes out of it?
Yeah, well, I think I mentioned one thing about helping to maybe suppress the fatal violence since then. But it also showed the steadfastness of workers. You mentioned that a lot of people today not appreciating what the union people went through then. They hear stories or they hear references to, the Ludlow Massacre and Haymarket and things like that. But the hundreds of thousands or millions of workers who were in danger of losing their jobs, went out on strike, sit-ins, which were incredibly dangerous, but were very successful for a while. People putting themselves on the line and picket lines, the numerous cases of police beating people on picket lines and strikers, maybe not 10 killed in a day, but so there's sort of an appreciation of what people had to go through. And today, of course, you still, as you mentioned, there is a surge in labor activity. I hope this film helps boost that, or I hope people who are getting excited about this, and the film does focus on this towards the end, all of these new actions in new fields, Amazon, Starbucks, Apple, we list some in the book, even very, very small, from a bank like Wells Fargo to a small company like Bandcamp, every day there are new fields. And then, you mentioned the Writers Guild, which is a more venerable organization, of course, very white collar, but they have quite a large, important strike now. So it is an exciting time. And I think the more people learn about how we got here, it can only help push that further.
And the struggles that it took to gain the things that were gotten. I think back to my grandparents and their generation. They literally came back from World War II fighting fascism overseas to coming to the shop floor and fighting for, that what we think now of as the American dream. That you work hard, play by the rules, get ahead. And I believe that compact has been broken for far too many working people. So I in this moment, I think people are looking for a way of reclaiming some kind of community, reclaiming some kind of prosperity. And the labor movement, for me, as I've been saying, for all 18 years doing this show, is that's how we rebuild, revive, reunite. We reunionize. At least that's my thought.
Well, this and again, this period going back to 1937 and what these strikers won was, something as basic as the 8-hour day, time and a half for overtime, weekends, the whole concept of a weekend. This is not that long ago. 1937 is not really all that long ago. People take for granted what these things produce. So, these people were real heroes to stick this out and brought it to all the other. There might have been a strike in an auto industry or steel or the miners, but it spread and was put in effect in other areas as well. It became the norm, so every victory was an important victory. And the steel strikers, even though they were beaten and killed and wounded on Memorial Day 1937, did eventually win their demands in terms of the, you know, getting the contract, getting the recognition, and getting what they were demanding.
Yeah, what they were fighting for. And at the end of the day, it still comes back to that war between labor and capital, and, you know, the power that capital has of news media and law enforcement and you know, the legal structure that tends to be against working people. And I fear we're kind of in the same moment. Last line of questioning I've got. I know you've got a Substacks page. I hope folks will take a look at that. How do we find that?
Well, if you go to Substack, you know, which is you get the newsletter in your mailbox if you subscribe. If you go to Substack, you search my name, and it's called Between Rock and Hard Place. So it focuses on music and politics. And, you know, I think you'll like that. And I should mention that, you know, the film on PBS, you'll be able to probably in horror see the film, the film footage that was suppressed. There's a lot of focus on the this cover-up and how it was broken. My book, I would recommend, because it's an oral history, and you have dozens of labor activists, many of whom were eyewitnesses that day, some of whom were wounded. So the book focuses more on the stories of the union people at the time, where the film focuses more on this footage and the cover-up that happened.
I hope folks will take a look at it. I know I'm going to, as a student of labor history. It's something I think is important that we pass down to the future generations. But Greg, I appreciate the time. Great film. I hope folks will take a look at it, either at pbs.org or over at gregmitchphoto.com/the-memorial-day-massacre. We'll get links out on social media so you can check that out. But Greg, thanks so much for the time. Appreciate it.
All right. Very happy to be here and talk to your audience particularly.
Thanks so much, Greg. Appreciate it. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this. Stick around.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I gotta tell you, I watched the film over at PBS.org, and it's well done. And they show the footage that was hidden, because, you know, who would not be angry at a bunch of cops just randomly shooting into a crowd of people who were peacefully assembling and demanding better wages, hours, conditions? And they go into how the newspapers all were, you know, they were rioting, they, you know, ruckus, they were, you know, all of this kind of framing that be afraid of those working people. Because remember back then, and this is something I didn't get into him with, but a lot of the people who worked in these factories, you know, they were immigrants. A lot of these people who, there were those people, and there was already that kind of, that division. But, you know, here were these folks who were all wanted the same thing. They wanted a better life. They wanted better wages, better conditions. They wanted the, you know, because the steel mills were much more dangerous back then. You know, they wanted opportunities. And you had the CEO, and they go into this, into the film, who was vehemently anti-union over his dead body. Was it ever going to happen? And these workers, they stuck together. And that was really the story of that, you know, my grandparents' generation and a little bit older. They fought these wars, these battles. And our history doesn't doesn't remember them. You know, honestly, until we started doing labor history in two a couple of years ago, I didn't realize just how many of these kind of events happened throughout our history. And yet we came up with 3 years of something happening every day to working people in this country. And you look, you know, we worked hard, but not that hard. So take a look at it. I think it's well worth it. We'll get links out on how that can get out and be seen. I think, again, in this moment of people, you know, saying we need to fight for better wages, hours, conditions, opportunities, understand what the past was might help us in the future. And remember, workers of the past didn't always stay on the happy side of the law. Sit-in strikes were not legal. You know, there was no law that said you have the right to sit in. No, these people took it in their own hands to fight for better. Because back in 1937, it was still almost illegal to be a union member. In 1935, you get the National Labor Relations Act. They're flexing their muscle a little bit. But the employer mindset is, no, I'm the master. You'll do what we say. So again, I think an interesting time, because there's so much that we have to look at what's going on today. When the money is against the people, when the moneyed interests, because there's this ongoing war of capital versus labor, and labor always seems to get the short end of the stick because we're so easily divided. And where I started off today, where I started off with the New York Times piece, which is why I was like, wow, the New York Times actually, knows how to spell the word solidarity. Good for them. They must be listening to the show. They even showed, look, that when working people are focused on the right issues and they get away from the stuff that's deliberately put in their road to divide them, they come to the right choices. They come to something that can move us forward. Just my thought. Kentucky, interesting Kentucky governor race coming up. Former UN ambassador Kelly Craft, who I guess is running in the hotly contested primary there in Kentucky. She said if elected, we quote, and I'm going to quote this, we will not have transgenders in our school system. I don't know what that means. I don't know if you're throwing them out. I don't know if you're going to go to their houses and dress them differently. I don't know if there's an indoctrination camp coming. I'm not quite sure what that means. But people should be kind of freaked out about the right-wing view on what we should do with our kids, especially in school. Because I go over to Tennessee again. Tennessee, with the senator there, Marsha Blackburn, who has said that she believes the way to keep our school safe is that grandparents could join up with military vets who are armed, retired cops. They could protect the school. She said they know to de-escalate situations. I've heard a lot of talk. I've talked a lot to them, and they like this idea. They are grandparents like we are. My husband and I are grandparents. And they want to be there to help protect children. I'm like, you mean the ones that, are shooting people in the driveway because they pulled into the wrong driveway? You mean the ones that are shooting kids, black kids, because they ring the doorbell? You mean the ones that are these old curmudgeons who are shooting people because a ball rolled into their yard? I don't know that a bunch of old curmudgeons with access to guns, as curmudgeon-y as they are, with a bunch of kids running around agitating them and annoying them, I don't know that that's the right. I'm just saying, I'm not quite sure. Not there with you, Marsha. But one thing I do know is not the guns, right? In fact, we're going to give. As I was reading that, my mind went to this place because, as a kid, I spent a lot of time around people of advanced age. My mother worked in a nursing home, and I remember some of the old folks with their eyesight failing, with their their reflexes not so great. I'm imagining some of those folks well armed, armed to the teeth with a hair trigger, and a a limited amount of patience. And I'm seeing nothing positive. But this is the kind of stuff we get from the right. There are no solutions there. There's no real solution there. That's to get her couple minutes on the F channel promoting guns and not doing any type of actual work. It's kind of frustrating. But the Kentucky thing, that's scary. Because I do see someone eventually coming out and say, no, we need indoctrination camps, re-education, like the Christian folk do. I'm waiting for it. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back after this. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1980. That was the day that as many as 90,000 people rallied for the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment in Grant Park in Chicago, Illinois. The proposed amendment to the Constitution read, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." The idea to amend the Constitution to ensure equal rights for women was first proposed by Alice Paul in 1923. In the late 1960s, with the second wave feminist movement, the push for the amendment gained momentum. At the time, women only made 59 cents for each dollar earned by men. Not all labor leaders supported the Equal Rights Amendment. Some worried that the proposed constitutional amendment would nullify existing labor protections for women in the workforce. They instead advocated for legislation around specific issues faced by women. Myra K. Wolfgang, a vice president of the Hotel and Restaurant Employees and Bartenders International Union, testified against the ERA before the Senate in 1970. The ERA passed Congress in 1972, but in order for the amendment to go into effect, 38 states had to ratify it. 30 quickly did so, but then a backlash against the legislation began to gain momentum. Illinois was the only northern state that was a holdout for ratifying the amendment. A massive rally was planned. That morning, the Chicago Tribune described the crowd that was expected, including representatives from labor, religion, show business, politics, and the home. Despite this massive turnout, the Equal Rights Amendment failed to win enough support in Illinois. The amendment fell three states short of becoming the law of the land. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm a child of privilege, not the privilege of money. I come from a family of small-town working people. But it was my privilege to grow up in the public schools of Denison, Texas. There I received the rich blessings of dedicated classroom teachers, a diverse student body, playground socialization, librarians, coaches, cafeteria and custodial workers, student politics, vocational training, and a deep appreciation for the unifying value of community and the common good. That's why I'm flabbergasted by today's clique of corporate profiteers, theocratic zealots, and laissez-faire knuckleheads who are lobbying furiously across the country to demonize, defund, and dismantle this invaluable social benefit. If ignorance is bliss, they must be ecstatic. Public schools do have some real problems. Politicians constantly slashing education budgets. Professional burnout created by understaffing and low pay. The devastating strain of a killer pandemic, and a new normal of assault rifle murders. But the profiteers, theocrats, and knuckleheads aren't interested in those. Instead, focusing on what they say is the fatal flaw in public education, teachers. Yes, the claim is that diabolical educators are perverting innocent minds by teaching America's actual history, showing students that the full diversity of humankind enriches our society and presenting our earth as something to be protected, not plundered. And worse, oh my gosh, many classroom teachers are union members. So teachers suddenly find themselves political pawns in the GOP's culture war. Our schools are a cesspool of Marxist indoctrination, squawked Senator Marco Rubio. And Donald Trump squealed that schools are run by, quote, radical left maniacs and pink-haired communists. This is Jim Hightower saying, these right-wing chicken littles are demonizing America's invaluable educators because they need someone for people to hate, providing cover for their unpopular plot to privatize education.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So yesterday on the program, we talked about the Time Magazine story it was the title. It was the headline that caught my attention. And I said, look, finally someone who can write a headline that matters. And they wrote about this Jordan Neely, who was killed on the train in New York. And the headline read, "Nobody cares about homeless people until they die." My response to that was, do they even care after? I don't think they do. But in this case, someone did. Got a lot of email response from folks angry at my position. So here to help walk through some of this, I've asked a good friend who is a homelessness advocate, someone who's been for years fighting for the rights of the homeless, our good friend Pat Lamar. She's also an author. She actually wrote our little book, Daddy, What's the Middle Class, which you can get by simply going to thericksmithshow.com. Pat, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me. By the way, happy birthday.
I was hoping to avoid that. Hoping to avoid
I
that.
I figured
but thank
you were
you.
Avoiding it, so I thought I'd get it out of the way really quick.
But walk me through this, because, this headline caught my attention, that people, only care about homeless people when they die. I've taken the position that not even then, which got a lot of negative feedback of me being insensitive. Am I wrong?
It's really hard to say you're insensitive when you make an observation after one has died, which nobody stopped, right? So who's the insensitive one here? The people who are saying, hey, man, I think you're choking him a little tight. He just pooped himself. I think he's dying. I mean, people were literally around this guy explaining you're killing him, and he proceeded to keep killing him. I do want to say, people, there are a lot of people who care about the homeless. About 2,000 of them helped me put 1,200 blankets on the west lawn of the U.S. Capitol in December for Homeless Remembrance Night. The problem is we got about 10 million homeless people and a couple of thousand who care about them. But I do want to stick up for the few people who really like take their time and their energy and dedicate it to people in need. There are people out there.
Right.
The problem is we have institutional disregard, right? We have this just unbridled, it's like we are, if you want to do a whole pile of American exceptionalism, we are the wealthiest. I don't know whether or not that's exceptional because we're so damn greedy, but we are the wealthiest. We are extremely imaginative. So we're among the most imaginative nation in the world. And yet we can't solve this problem of no homes for people who don't have homes.
Yep.
And in order to make sure that everybody can sleep at night, except, of course, the people who don't have a home, we just perpetuate the lie about who it is. I ran shelters for the better part of a decade, and I kept records. Now, they're basically anecdotal because it was only Carlisle-based shelters in central Pennsylvania, but 55% of the people in my shelters worked. They had a job. They had an income. And 30% more were their children. So 85% of the people in my shelter were the working poor and their kids. They're not, we don't even have a conversation about that. And when you start trying to have a conversation about that, you're really shut up. You're completely shut up. I mean, even our massive art installation at the Capitol, we interviewed all kinds of big shots, heads of agencies and senators and congresspeople. We had all these people involved, but we couldn't talk about the definition of homelessness. Nobody wanted to talk about that. We couldn't talk about the things that if we change them would actually make a huge substantive difference. And this man on the Neely, this man is a perfect example of that. So one of the things that Housing and Urban Development does is they assess your vulnerability and you get a vulnerability quotient. And based on your vulnerability quotient, they decide whether or not they can help you. And the amount of available money in the wealthiest nation in the world just keeps shrinking.
Yeah.
Right? So they don't have much money to help. So it's only the people with the absolute highest vulnerability quotients on a scale of 0 to 16, the 16s, that get help. This guy was a 16, and he still didn't get help. The system is just like, it's underfinanced. And the thing that, so Housing and Urban Development is in charge of homelessness. And the largest amount of money does not go to Section 8 or public housing. The largest amount of money goes to the middle class tax break. We spend more money using the middle class as a pass through to big banks. You can deduct your mortgage payment so you can get a bigger mortgage. You can spend more for your house. The taxpayer will finance your mortgage and they'll pay your mortgage payment so the big banks can lend you more money. And I think that's great. Great middle class tax break. I'm not saying to get rid of it.
Now my mind's going, now you're framing this as this is the working class against the working class. This is the people who are doing okay versus the people who are certainly not. And for me, I'm not in line with that frame, because we've got way too many billionaires who are doing way too well. We've got so many people who are struggling. So for me, that's the fight for me.
And that is, but see, remember who's making the fight for us. You got to look at this guy, Neely, and everybody else who's on the street and think about them as your threat. It's that joke about the guy with the one cookie and the guy with the
crumbs. You're right. But here's the thing. Is the thing. I mean, as I said this right from the beginning, when I heard about this case, I said, I don't know everything about it. I've heard, but what I know is when there's a lack of humane solutions, inhumane solutions fill the void. And to me, that's what this looks like. We did nothing. We didn't do enough to help keep this guy, sane. We didn't do enough to protect the people on the train. However you want to frame this, we didn't do enough, and inhumane solutions filled the void.
But the people on the train weren't in any danger. So that's the other thing.
I don't know that to be true. I don't know that to be true or false.
There's absolutely, from what I can see, there's absolutely no evidence that this guy was ever a threat to anybody. He liked to pretend he was Michael Jackson. I have people who call me the peasant whisperer.
Right.
I think it's a compliment. But, someone will be stuck in somewhere in central Pennsylvania in trouble, and I'll get a phone call. So there's a guy out in the snow tonight. Okay. There's a woman with a suitcase in my neighborhood. People literally call me up and say this stuff to me. Well, there's nothing wrong with having a suitcase in your neighborhood. It's not against the law. There's nothing wrong. There's a man outside in the cold. Do you think he's going to freeze to death? Well, he might freeze to death. He's been out there and it's really cold. And I'll say, well, call him an ambulance. Do not call him a police officer. If you want deadly force, that's when you call the police.
But that's what we've been trained to do. I mean, sadly, this is what's happened over the years. Law enforcement has been the one who has to clean up the mess. And we expect way too much out of the police. And I say all the time, I support the police when they're not wrong. There are times when dealing with people with mental illness and dealing with the homeless where they are wrong and should be held accountable. But I go back to the lack of humane solutions lead to inhumane outcomes.
It's more that horizontal hostility, right? So they're going to pit us against the police next. Instead of saying we need more money for the problem so that there's somebody to call that doesn't use deadly force as their solution to a problem, right? You want the police when you want deadly force, and you really don't want them any other time. We need a group of people that show up that can manage the system, not some guys in the middle of the street screaming at cars so someone comes and kneels on their back till he's dead. That's not the solution to the problem, right? But we don't want to put any money into this problem. We don't want to invest in housing for this poor man that died on the subway. And if we do invest our tiny little amounts of it, we have to make the middle class feel like they're going to lose their tax break if we have more Section 8.
Right, because that's why I stopped you.
There's all hostility going, right?
Right, and that's why I stopped you with the whole banking comparison, because that's what I heard. Well, it's the middle class's fault for getting these tax breaks, I'm going to lose mine. So immediately people are going to shut down.
No, but the thing is that all I want the middle class to know is they get housing assistance.
Okay.
They get housing assistance, but they don't want this guy on the train to get housing assistance. So when you're in the I got mine category and you've got a $200,000 mortgage, that you can take off of your, you take your $1,500 a month of interest payments right off your taxes, right? Well, then you get housing assistance. And there's no reason that that poor slob who just made your cheeseburger, who doesn't have anywhere to shower, by the way, bon appetit, there's no reason that guy can't have housing assistance too, because you get it, right?
So let me ask you, if you've got the magic wand, because you know there's a lot of people saying, well, what do we do? It seems like such an insurmountable problem. You look at, you know, San Francisco, because we see tons of video from San Francisco of all the homeless people there with their drug addiction problems, because the frame is all the homeless are just drug addicts. What do you do? How do you solve this problem? How do we get to humane solutions then?
All you got to do is the war on poverty. I mean, by the time Ronald Reagan was elected, the poverty level in the United States was under 10%. Ronald Reagan got elected, and now we're at 20 to 25% poverty, right? So what happened was every single support for the low-income worker, basically, and low-income elder, elder orphans are a big problem on the street now. The elderly are rapidly, one of the fastest growing groups on the street. So we have this elder orphan problem, and we have people who don't have anyone to take them in when their Social Security is only $1,000 a month. And we've got all of these problems because we won't invest in people. And we won't invest in this low-wage worker. We won't invest in the people. And now, I mean, even Bernie Sanders is $15 an hour is too low. He's up to $17. People can't live on the measly wages that they're getting. And people crack wise like, oh, well, I think I'll go to work at Chick-fil-A because they're at $16 an hour now. And, you know, I'm looking at a guy who wouldn't last 15 hours in Chick-fil-A. He'd be getting hauled off for swearing at somebody in their car, right? You wouldn't put up with the crap a Chick-fil-A worker puts up with, or a McDonald's worker, or, you know? So we've got this. And we've got billionaires. We've got Elon Musk, who's I see a Tesla, I just want to run it off the road. I'm like, why would you give him any money?
It's the same way I feel about a blue check mark. Would you give him $8 when you can give that to somebody on the street corner who's hungry? But how, again, you know, you talk about the war on poverty. And I remember Reagan's war on the poor. I remember as they shattered the social safety net. Ketchup is a vegetable. I remember them slashing the school lunch programs in the summer where I grew up, where you went to the Purtis Elementary School and lined up in the summertime for a hot lunch. And for, like I've said a million times, for those kids in that line, it was the only hot meal they got all day. That all went away for tax cuts for the wealthy. So you're saying this is just a money problem. It's just we're not spending enough money.
It literally is the one thing when they said you can't solve that just by throwing money at it. Well, you can this. You can throw money at it and you can solve it. We need housing. It would make jobs. 30 units of affordable housing makes 100 jobs.
Now, what do you say?
And it wasn't just Reagan. It was Clinton. And I write for the Bucks County Beacon. I just did a story about the TANF, the changing families. Do you know what Pennsylvania does? Pennsylvania siphons off 89% of that money. Only 11% of TANF block grants actually go to families in need. You want to know why families are still in need? Because there are 3,000 families getting the money and 30,000 that need it. And all that money's going to other places like crisis pregnancy centers to lie to our pregnant people and tell them that absolutely no neonatal care. Those TANF block grants are going to crisis pregnancy centers where religious people are preaching whatever lies they want to about having a baby with no health care provided, and they're getting $1.07 a minute. So someone's making over $60 an hour to lie to pregnant people and not help them. So, okay, what's the answer to no abortion? Prenatal care. They're not getting prenatal care. Instead, we're closing hospitals. And this is temporary aid to needy families. You want to know how you, that welfare money that actually used to help children, they don't even get it.
No, look, I'm not too proud to admit that when I was a kid, my mother a time or two had to get food stamps. And I still remember still remember that. And it was one of the most humiliated moments of my life. And I'll still remember that till the day I die. But it was there to make sure that there was at least something. It wasn't the posh existence that I hear from right wing people that they want to say, oh, living the high life with the, you know, with the swimming pools and those projects. No, it was a meager existence. What you're saying is they've taken that.
Right. Food stamp. This is that money that's just supposed to help you pay the electric bill, right? Because food stamps will buy you food, but it doesn't buy you sanitary products. It doesn't buy you diapers. It doesn't pay your electric bill. It doesn't, you know, you've got, even if you can afford your rent, this is going to, and the average person who gets TANF in Pennsylvania gets $250 a month. What is that doing? And we've got $711 million stockpiled in Pennsylvania. I'm interviewing the new Speaker of the House of Pennsylvania tomorrow about it. $711 million stockpiled of this money. Why have we got a homeless problem? Why have we got people riding the subways because they don't have anywhere to live? Because we're stealing the money that's made to help them. Yeah, fix it. Throw money at it. Oh, no. When, as soon as you start throwing money, somebody turned it into a block grant and it got siphoned off to something else.
Yeah. Now, I want to go back before we wrap this up. You said that we're one of the most, we're a creative country. It seems to me that there's got to be a way to solve this problem. It seems to me there's got to be a creative way. And I've seen numerous places throughout the country. Denver has a giant warehouse where they have, you know, small apartments and wraparound services and all kinds of stuff to bring people to. I've seen places that do tiny little house villages. I've seen a bunch of ideas. Is there a right way? Is there a way that you would advocate for? Is there a way to solve this? Because, look, I look at this Jordan Neely, who, you know, evidently, you know, hit an old lady, and in exchange for him going to jail, they sent him to a rehab center, and he left within 2 weeks. So, you know, what do you say to the person who goes, hey, we tried to help, they didn't want it? How do you deal with that?
Well, I'll tell you, when I was sending people to rehab, I'd call and say, yeah, we got a bed, it'll open up a week from Tuesday. Make sure they keep using. Make sure they test hot. If that guy manages to kick his cocaine and he doesn't test hot when he gets here, we won't help him. So I had to go back to my homeless guy who was a heroin addict. And I used to have to say, hey, look, keep using, but don't use so much that you die. And they will take you a week from Tuesday because we don't have enough rehab beds. Right. So when housing professionals or the rehab people, when they have someone who says, hey, I want to leave, and you know, you got 16 people in line who want that bed, you say, okay, because this other guy wants help. And you do the best you can because you've been given the absolute most massive garbage sandwich and you're just trying to eat it and save maybe one person before you retire in 35 years. And it's unbelievable how we are not investing the resources necessary, even though we know it would help, right? And most people, they don't need that huge wraparound service. They need to be able to afford a $2,000 apartment, because that's what the average is now, on $1,500 a month. So they just need help, period.
Yeah, I've argued that we need to start building Levitt towns again. Lots of homes being built to give people access to get, like my grandparents' generation got, good, solidly built homes at reasonable costs so that they can raise their families, and it seems the way forward.
I have a question real quick for you. How much is your electric bill right now?
My last month was $330.
Right. $330. Are you paying that on a low wage? No. $330 electric bill. You know what we could do to stop homelessness? We could pay people's electric bills. Because if you let your electricity go behind, you get evicted. You get evicted, then you have bad credit, then you can't get a new apartment. And you can't get a new apartment till you pay the old bill. So now you've got $1,400 in electric bills. It's not hard to figure out why people are homeless. It's hard to figure out why we don't, like you said, care till they're dead.
Yeah. It's not surprising that people are struggling. They don't have any money. And I think we learned that during the pandemic. But Pat, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the passion and the information. I would say good stuff, but not really. This is angering stuff. This should be ticking us off. But I appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, our good friend Pat LaMarche. Remember, check out her work over at BucksCountyBeacon.com, where she does writing over there. I highly suggest it. Let's take a quick break, right back to wrap things up. Stick around. Listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. One more time. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1869. At 2:47 p.m., a one-word telegram was sent from Promontory Summit, Utah. The message read simply, "Done." That understated message marked the end of one of the most incredible projects ever completed by working people in the United States, the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. The arduous work of laying the rail track across the continent was completed by a predominantly ethnic workforce. It has been estimated that workers swung hammers some 21 million times, laying the track along more than 1,100 miles. Irish workers performed the dangerous work for the Union Pacific Rail Company, building the track from the east. Chinese labor made up 3/4 of the Central Pacific crews constructing from the west. Laying the track through the Sierra Nevada mountain range meant blasting through solid granite. Chinese laborers used highly volatile nitroglycerin to make way for the railroad. On some days, the track progressed as little as just a few feet. The Central Pacific Company reported that 137 workers died on the project. Newspaper reporters claim to have seen many, many more bodies of Chinese workers. The true death toll will never be known. Both the Irish and Chinese workers not only experienced brutal working conditions, but also had to deal with discrimination. The track also cut through territories of Native American land. The railroad encroached on this land and further accelerated the displacement of Native American people. When the final golden spike was driven into the track at Promontory Summit, the nation was forever changed. The trip across the continent, which previously would take up to 6 grueling months, had been reduced to just 2 weeks.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us at Labor History in Two. Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. You know, I like Pat a lot. Pat's a good friend of mine, and it's because she's so passionate about this issue. And, you know, a lot of the email I got from folks were, you know, well, the people made decisions, they made choices. It's, you know, yeah, and there are some. There's always going to be that anecdotal bit, but the part that she hit on that I did not, and I'm glad she didn't, it's the reason that I brought her on to talk about this, is the majority of the homeless folks are working poor, and it, as she was telling this story, it reminded me of one of the encounters we had during our Hungry and Homeless for the Holiday events, where a couple with a kid with a daughter, right about my oldest daughter's age, and I think, you know, she would have been probably around 10 at the time. They came to where our encampment was. And because they had heard it on the radio, and, you know, we gave them some food and stuff out of the truck, and they were looking for jobs because they had both lost their jobs, and they both lost their jobs, and they were, you know, already behind on their payments to their rent, and they were living out of their cars. These are people who wanted jobs. They wanted to work. And I remember sending, you know, the husband to a couple of places that folks that I knew that might be hiring. And eventually they did get a job, and the story turned out well. But in this moment, they were living in their car. And I'll never forget the little girl. As long as I live, I'll never forget how heartbreaking it was. Because they stood and they talked to us for like about an hour. And when it was time to go, the poor little girl was just sobbing. Now, I had given my daughter a couple of bucks. They went into the supermarket. They bought ice cream. And they were playing like little girls play. They were like two friends without a care in the world at that moment. But the second the parents said, "Come on, we've got to go," reality came falling down on that child. And I remember in that moment, and I'll never forget it, I remember thinking how fortunate I was to be in the position that I was in. how fortunate I was that I didn't have to look in my daughter's eyes and know that was our reality. And the fact that we don't do enough to help people when they're down on their luck. We don't do that helping hand thing. We've, as I said at the beginning, we've turned into a hooray for me and the heck with everybody else society. Question is, how do we use policy? How do we get back to? How do we get back to that we want to help? I want to know what you think. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Share your stories if you have any.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.